Welcome to A Moment of Bach, where we take our favorite moments from the composer's vast musical output, just a minute's worth or even a few seconds, and show you why we think that they are remarkable. We are your hosts, Christian and Alex Giebert. Today we hear a moment from the third movement of the Sonata for Viola da Gamba and Harpsichord, BWV 1027. Any good artist knows how to use the element of repetition. And any good artist knows how to repeat the best material and exactly how many times to repeat the best material. And any good artist knows that if you repeat something too much, it gets stale, but if you don't repeat something enough, it might not be memorable. Any good artist might also know that less is more, and a simple approach can sometimes be better than a complex one. It seems kind of weird to say in a podcast about Bach when part of the reason why he's so great is his complexity. While that's true, sometimes the simplest elements are the most memorable. In this sonata for viola da gamba and harpsichord, Bach includes a repeated figure, and that figure is one note. It's about as simple as you could get. It's a one-note theme. And I think you could make the case that when he does this in this sonata, which has four movements, when he does this one-note theme, he does it in every movement, and he does it at important structural points in the movements. And I think he's connecting the movements in a certain way. A lot of composers of this era did not really feel that they needed to connect multiple movements of a larger work with thematic musical material, because that wasn't really necessary. You needed contrasting material. You didn't really need connecting material as much. But here, we see this through line. So out of these four movements, my moment comes from the third, but I do want to talk a little bit about each, and I want to show you the one note theme that I'm talking about. And to do that, let's start with the first movement at the very beginning. First thing you hear is a melody in the viola da gamba as the harpsichord plays a simple bass line. It sounds like a two-part texture, but it's really three, because there's one long note being held in the harpsichord. Since that note dies off pretty quick, it doesn't really sound like another texture, but our harpsichordist, Emanuel Frankenberg, chooses to add a trill to this after a few beats. So we can hear that it is supposed to be one long note. And then, as is Bach's normal strategy, the harpsichord gets the melody that the viola da gamba previously had, and then the viola da gamba gets the long note. Here, we can hear the long note sustained on this beautiful instrument, played beautifully by Minneke van der Velden, who is a soloist that plays a lot for the Netherlands Bach Society. She plays here on an original instrument, an instrument that was made in 1617. Wow. The viola da gamba has a specific tone quality that's different from the modern cello, which is probably its closest analog in terms of pitch range. It has more strings than the cello, and it has a sort of thinner, more plaintive sound. And when she comes in on that note there on the fourth measure of music, it's kind of ethereal and a little bit otherworldly. It doesn't sound, or at least to my ears, which I'm so used to a modern cello sound. I love this Baroque viola da gamba sound. I love how, I don't really want to use the word thin because it doesn't sound thin. It sounds thinner than a modern cello sound.
Yeah, lighter. And it's less bright. It's like darker.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more veiled somehow.
Right. And I mean, Netherlands Bach Society is always using period instruments, or at least reconstructions of period instruments, and a lot of times the Baroque strings have this quality, no matter what the range. The Baroque violin also is a thinner sound.
That's true. But the viola da gamba is part of the viol family, so it's not actually really even much like a cello at all, except for the size and general range. It's a viol, which had a bunch of different sizes, but they all died out.
So is the violone, like the large one, that's also a part of that family?
Yeah, I think that's why it's tuned in fourths, the bass, the modern bass.
Okay, yeah.
But yes, the violone was that member of that family, I think. But they mostly all got replaced by the modern, like, violin, viola, and cello, because those instruments were, I think, easier to manage and brighter and louder.
Right.
For the more modern orchestras.
Well, and playing something like this is actually a real challenge nowadays because, let's say you want to use a cello instead of a viola da gamba. Okay, great. It's probably still doable on a cello, even though string position-wise it might not be exactly what Bach had intended. But then you run against the problem of that might be a little too bright sounding against a harpsichord. Maybe you want to do that on piano instead of harpsichord, make it sound more modern. Okay, well now I don't think those timbres are going to work. They're going to fight in the lower register of the piano. They're not like the harpsichord is so tinkly and bright and like sparkly. I think frequency wise and tone color wise, the piano and the cello are not as compatible in this range. Like later composers would write piano trios and stuff for piano and cello, and they would be writing for what's closer to our modern instruments. And so those considerations are different, and those pieces sound a little more natural for those. Although, for my money, I never really can dig a piano trio that much because I always feel like the cello and the left hand of the piano are always fighting anyway.
Yeah, I think the most successful musical texture in a piano trio is when the strings are in the middle and there's some really interesting, like really high or really low piano. But that's pretty modern. I mean, I don't think that happens a lot. But usually the classical composers treated the piano trio like in that kind of way where the cello is like a second solo instrument, not a bassline instrument, because otherwise it's not really doing much. The piano is so heavy in that bottom range.
Right.
And so, yeah, you're right, Alex. The older instruments were like quieter also, just very, sure. To put it simply, they were quieter. The gamba was quiet. The recorders were quieter. That's why they work well together, like in Gottes Zeit. And the oboe was quieter back in the day. The oboe de Moor, right. The viola de Moor, these were all softer instruments, and they got paired together a lot with the viola da gamba.
Right. And here, we don't get like what a modern cello might get in an orchestra part, which is a lot of bass or bass-adjacent stuff. This is, as we said, a sonata, so it's a feature thing. And the viola da gamba gets solo billing here. And really what Bach does, and this is typical, is that Bach has the harpsichord playing a two-part texture, just one part in each hand, and really the solo instrument and the right hand of the harpsichord have the imitative material. They are the two voices that are talking to each other. And then the bass voice, the left hand of the harpsichord, is simply a bass voice. You know, that's where that is. He doesn't really put the viola da gamba in a bass function in this work.
No.
So really you could rearrange this if you wanted to, even if you had to change the key, you could, and then you could put it in, let's say, organ and violin, or you could put it in three different, you could make it for flute, clarinet, and bassoon, whatever, you know, like you could do these things. It would lose something, but it would also gain something interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, Bach probably did rearrange this for other instruments at some point too. There's another version, and I'm pretty sure we know this is Bach, that this is done by Bach, which is two transverse flutes and continuo of this same piece. So now we've talked a little bit about instrumentation and sound texture. Now let's talk a little bit about form. Because again, I love the way these are linked by this one note motive. And let's listen to the first movement here. And we just heard that one note, that long note. Let's hear another time in this movement when that happens in the harpsichord again. So that permeates the texture, right? And then near the end, he does a thing which I kind of love, which is that he brings us down into a half cadence, and it's a little bit unusual. So the music is in G major, and he ends on a D chord. He steps down in the bass, G, F, E, E flat, and finally D, and landing on a half cadence there. So this means that we need to go on to movement two now, right? Well, no. He gives us another little fake out. I just love that, and I love how much time they spend on that rest in this recording. After that first dominant chord, you think that's it. You're ready for them to start a fast second movement, and they don't. They go on to this other thing, this cute little trill. Back to the half cadence again. And then the second movement, the fast tempo begins. So that moment really stuck out to me, but it's my second favorite moment because my favorite comes in the third movement. But let's take a look at these long note themes in the second movement also, show how they connect. Okay, so that was a little bit of a long note in the Piola da Gamba there. So is he gonna do it in the harpsichord part at some point? Yes, and he adds a little trill there too. And then we end on this just open unison G. So that's actually our first like real satisfying cadence, because the first movement didn't have an authentic cadence at the end. But now we come to my favorite part. And I don't know why this is my favorite part, but going back to what I was explaining earlier, sometimes less is more, and sometimes you don't even really need much of a melody. You just create an interesting texture. And in this third movement, marked andante, which is like a sort of moderate walking speed, we kind of get this plodding thing that happens. These dun, 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 dun. And in the left hand of the harpsichord, bum, 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 bum. It's not really melodic, but with Bach, there's always a deep sense of connection and structure between the moving parts. And of course, here, this is what we have. And if you look closely, what he's doing is that the harpsichord gives us two beats of music, or it might feel like four beats because it's so slow, but one E and two, and then the viola da gamba, three E, and comes in on three. So the viola da gamba is actually imitating the harpsichord part here. Every two beats, it is basically playing the same thing that the harpsichord played the two beats before. It's not exactly the same pitch-wise, but it's the same motion-wise. And once you see that, you realize that's the structure that he's going to use for this whole movement. And then a little bit later, it changes, and you might think, oh, he stopped doing that. But he doesn't stop. He just stretches it into four beats. So now it's like the harpsichord has a little figure that's four beats long. Then the viola da gamba imitates it for the next four beats. But this kind of thing is really hard to notice as a listener because they're happening simultaneously. You can't really focus on it. It's not like listening to a conversation of one person saying something, or even someone copying someone else's speech. It's not like that. It's because they're overlapping. So maybe a better analogy would be like if you're watching a video of somebody speaking a different language and there is a translation being spoken over them. That translation is translating it a little bit late. It's translating it with a little delay. And that's kind of what this is. Until my favorite moment, which is near the end, which is measure 13. And I mean, if you know about sheet music and musical structures on a page, you'll realize that measure 13 doesn't sound like it's very far into a piece. That's, most pieces are a lot longer than 13 measures, but this one is only 18 measures, and that's because of the plodding slow tempo. And then measure 13, if you listen to the viola da gamba, you'll hear the long note. But then listen, keep listening to the long note. When I first heard this, what struck me about this was just how long it was. That it seemed like it was never going to stop. Still going, she's still going.
Did you time it?
Ooh, no, but let's look at that right now. Started at 10:09, okay, 10:42 or so. So, I mean, that's over 30 seconds.
I think I counted.
That's incredible, really.
Four bow strokes, maybe five. They were really slow, but yeah. I mean, this can't be done in one bow, so you just keep going and you try to make it as smooth as possible.
Right.
But Bach would have known that, so he didn't think that was a problem, I guess.
But also, it's a little bit more special than like just an organ pedal point, for example, which is easier to do. You're just holding down a key. Or like a harpsichord pedal point, which you have to sort of sustain with a trill, like we said before. So it makes it less of a real sustain. Or a wind instrument, which Bach sometimes did write long notes for, but he was usually pretty considerate when it came to the fact that wind players have to breathe. But for this is kind of unusual in another way, not just because it's a long, long note for the viola da gamba, which is unusual, but also because of the range. It's not a bass pedal point. It is a low E, but it's not that low. And the other harpsichord material that's happening around it, it encircles it in pitch. When she starts this pedal point, the harpsichord low note in the left hand is the same pitch at the same octave. And then he starts going down the scale with that, if you listen. Whereas she keeps this E, so she's not underneath the texture, she's in the middle of it. And Bach, of course, cleverly makes sure that all these chords that are happening here will work with the pedal point E inside of it to close us out into an interesting cadence. Then when she finally does move, it's really the second to last measure of the whole thing here. That's what really closes us onto a cadence, but it's not E. We don't end on E. The whole long note was a big long E, and we are in E minor, but Bach does not end us on E. And I think that is the secret sauce of this movement. If it was just one long E like that, that would be interesting and it would be unusual. But then if he would end on E, it would actually be kind of anticlimactic. But here, the fact that he ends on B, after sitting on E for so long that he doesn't even end that, but he ends on a half cadence, it just makes the beginning of movement four, which just goes right back into a sprightly G major. it just makes that so much more fun, because then it just takes you right out of the clouds, brings you into this little sunny, happy G major thing, which takes you to the end of the whole piece.
I used to think it was really jarring when an internal slower movement would end on a half cadence like that, making that chord seem out of key for the next thing, because that's the, you know, 5 of 6 in the next thing if you're using a Roman numeral analysis. But that's not really what's happening. What's really happening is, like you said, like leaving something open-ended on purpose so that the contrast of the next thing can be a little bit more in your face, I guess.
Yeah, I think so.
And it happened all the time. It wasn't just Bach doing that. It's a great little effect to sort of meander off into the unresolved half cadence in minor, which gives you that sharped note, only to then go on to just like a happy dallying little allegro in a major key at the end.
Right. It's almost like an insistence on positivity at the end there. Also, the long notes, of course, make a reappearance here near the end of this movement. They happen in the viola da gamba. And in the harpsichord. Then we close out with another just unison G at the end. Which is almost a little bit stark, but it does work because it was actually set up before, because we had that same kind of thing at the end of movement two.
Those long notes are usually D or E, it seems like.
Yeah.
Not that that means that he chose D and E to be the long notes for this sonata, although maybe he did, but it's also just that that makes sense to be the long notes, because our overall key is G, so D is an important note in the key of G because it's the fifth scale degree and it's a place we're going to be spending a lot of time in. And so is E, but that's more of a contrast thing because that's where we find the relative minor, and that's where our slower middle part of a sonata is generally going to be set in that key, E minor. So it makes sense, but it's also really nice. It's a really nice way to tie everything together. And like you said, Alex, Bach took a little bit more care than some other of his contemporaries to make something like this hang together compositionally by putting this long note motif in there. That's really kind of unexpected. Like, we're not counting on that.
Yeah, right. And now, here is the ending moment with the long note at the end of the andante of the Viola da Gamba Sonata, BWV 1027.
If this introduction to a musical moment has inspired you to hear the rest of the sonata, please check the link in the episode description for the video performance by the Netherlands Bach Society. And please tell someone about a moment of Bach today. Tell someone you think might want to listen.
Yeah. All right, Christian. What did you pick for season 4, episode 4?
We're going to do something a little different. We're going to do a moment of Vivaldi.
What?
Yeah, our format in this show has always been to use the Netherlands Bach Society recordings or a guest, some musical guest, to listen to one of their recordings of a piece by Bach. But they don't only play Bach, they just mostly do, especially now that they're trying to go through his complete catalog. But if you scroll back far enough, you can see that they have posted some other things too, and of course they play a lot of other Baroque music. So I'd like to take a break from Bach for 1 week and take a look at the Vivaldi Four Seasons, specifically Winter, the really stunning performance of that by the Netherlands Bach Society.
Until next time, enjoy those moments.